Hi there, it's Sarah Raymond, and I am beyond excited to share some news with you today. My new book, You Are Not Broken, A Compassionate Guide to Uncovering Inner Wisdom and Transforming Your Life with Hypnotherapy, is now available. This book is a deep dive into the very practices offered here and with my one-on-one clients, combining hypnotherapy, somatic healing, and trauma-informed coaching to help you release those nagging beliefs that tell you you're not enough. It's filled with practical step-by-step exercises designed to transform limiting beliefs and embrace your true whole self. Whether you're struggling with anxiety, perfectionism, or just seeking a deeper sense of self-acceptance, You Are Not Broken offers the tools and insights you need to uncover your inner wisdom and live a more compassionate and fulfilling life. Head over to Amazon and get your copy of You Are Not Broken today. Thank you for your continued support, and I look forward to hearing feedback from this amazing community. Stay curious and compassionate, and remember, you are whole. You are enough.
The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Diabetes can be reversed, but it cannot be cured. The word cure means you make it go away and it's gone forever and there's nothing you can do to bring it back. But that's not the case. If you improve your diabetes using exercise, nutrition, supplements, and then 3 months later you stop eating the way you used to eat to reverse your diabetes, you stop exercising, you stop taking the supplements, your diabetes will come back.
Igor Klebanov, thank you for joining me on the Mindful Movement Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Les. I'm looking forward to this.
So you are quite the writer. You've put together how many books, Igor?
16 now.
That's a lot of books. I can't imagine. You sent me your most recent one, Type 2 Diabetes Reversal.
Yep, Reversal Secrets, that's the one.
And that's interesting. There you go. Over the years in the gym environment, I've worked with a lot of clients. Some of them have struggled with diabetes and blood sugar management and such. And it's interesting, as I've tried to learn more and more over the years about the relationship of nutrition and physiology and lifestyle in general with physiology, it's my mind has been all over the place. Like, I've been convinced so many different ways over the years, and I'm intrigued to hear your opinion that, you know, you've actually obviously put a lot of time in this and you've worked with clients individually navigating this. So I'm intrigued to hear what's worked for you.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot that went into it. And like you, initially in my career, I was swayed heavily by, you know, this guru says this, but this guru says that. Once I started, well, ignoring the gurus and reading the research, my opinions became a lot more solid, and it took way, way, way more evidence to convince me that something isn't the way I thought. And I actually like reading evidence that contradicts what I say. I don't just want to reread what reinforces what I say, because when I learn the most when I learn things that disagree with me. But the more rigorous I am about the research, about the methodology of the research, the more it takes to convince me that my view is wrong.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I personally, looking into research, have found myself struggling to be able to put a lot of weight in a lot of the research that's out there. I mean, there was a phase where I was paying a lot of attention to the nuances of how studies were done.
Yes.
And really came to the conclusion that a lot of the data that studies put out aren't as useful as they try to convince you.
Yep, absolutely. When I read the abstract and I see the conclusion of the abstract, then I dive deeper into the paper itself. I'm like, how did they reach that conclusion? That makes no sense when I look at the raw data. So I completely get what you're saying.
Yeah, I found myself in that situation. Also, I think a lot of the studies, and part of this is probably because the cost and just the sheer logistics it takes to put together a good study, with especially when you're dealing with like nutritional interventions. Some of them are, it's like, it might be a decent study, but they run it for 8 weeks, and what you really need is 8 years.
Yeah.
And it's not realistic to do it in a way that you see like the real long-term effect of something.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat as you. When I read the studies about a nutrition or exercise, they say, well, group A outperformed group B over 8 weeks. But then I'm wondering to myself, well, what if it extended to, you know, 6 months to a year? Then would it equalize?
Right. And also it's like, what are they compared to? Like in exercise, there's a lot of studies that say this is better than that. But it's like they're comparing one way to another, but there's an infinite things in between that they're not comparing. And like the minimum effective dose might be like way lower than what the study is conveying. But because they only compared it to one other option, you know, you don't really know. There's not a lot of, they're just limited. And I think it's just the nature of, it's really hard to put together good studies. It's expensive.
Yes.
It's hard. You have to get institutional review boards to say, yet to allow you to do things. There's a lot of obstacles and it's just challenging.
Yeah, absolutely. There is a problem with individual studies, which is where I like my analyses and systematic reviews, because if you get a bunch of studies that on their own have only bits and pieces of the puzzle, you put those all together into a meta-analysis or a systematic review, and then you read it, you have way more sense of power, way more validity, and now you can actually do subgroup analyses and figure out what actually works.
Gotcha. So let's talk a little bit about diabetes, because the framework I thought about diabetes has changed a lot over the years. I've even heard it like kind of defined differently. What's the framework you're using? How do you look at what diabetes is?
Yeah, so the very simple raw definition that almost everyone can agree on is high blood sugar. That's it. Now, there are two types of diabetes. There's type 1 and type 2 diabetes. The end result is the same, high blood sugar, but the reason for high blood sugar is different between the two. In type 1, you just don't have enough insulin or any insulin to bring down the blood sugar. But in type 2, you have plenty of insulin. You might even have too much insulin. It's just that the cells don't hear the message of insulin. The issue is more insulin resistance as opposed to inadequate insulin. But again, the end result is the same, which is high blood sugar. That's kind of the view that I take, and is more or less, these are the definitions that are more or less agreed upon.
Gotcha. So you look at it's just the number itself of how much sugar is in the blood is too high. It's higher than like normal.
Part of it is that, but there are also other factors. There is the factor of how much insulin is required to bring blood sugar down to normal, because two people might have perfect blood sugar. Maybe, I'll speak in my units, maybe it's 5.0 millimoles per liter, which is considered more or less perfect. But one person might need, I don't know, 16 units of insulin to bring it to normal. Another person might need 9 units of insulin to bring it to normal. The person who has who only needs 9 is the healthier person.
Because they're more sensitive to the insulin they're making, or?
Exactly. They require less insulin to keep their blood sugar normal.
And why is it inherently like less healthy to just produce more insulin if it gets you the same number? What's wrong with insulin that if you just produce more, if it helps regulate your blood sugar, why would that be a problem?
Yeah. So with anything in the body, we don't want too little of it or too much of it. We want just the right amount of it. We certainly don't want zero insulin, well, that's called a type 1 diabetic, right? We don't want that either. We don't want excessive insulin, that's insulin resistance. So we want a normal amount. And why is that? Well, for a number of different reasons. The research is actually moving in the direction of showing that what's the real problem with obesity? What is it about obesity that shortens lifespan, health span, etc.? Is it just body fat? Or is it excessive insulin, hyperinsulinemia? And actually, hyperinsulinemia could be more damaging than the body fat itself. Which brings us back to the question of what's wrong with excessive insulin? Insulin is inherently a storage hormone, which is a good thing and a bad thing. It makes you store stuff. It makes you store sugar, which is great. You need to store 90 grams in your liver. You need to store about 350 grams in your muscles. You also need to store other things. You need to store amino acids in your muscles, in your bones, in your brain, neurotransmitters, etc. So that's what insulin does. Now,
just to clarify, insulin is a signal that allows your cells to take that nutrition or energy into the cell.
Exactly. Whatever the cell may be, muscle cell, liver cell, heart cell, etc. Now, the problem is when insulin is excessive, it creates too much excessive damage, like free radicals, like it throws off other hormones such as testosterone. So in women who have high insulin and high testosterone, they have PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome. One of my other books was actually about that. In other people who have excessive insulin, they also get leptin resistance. In other words,
Can you slow down a little bit? So you're saying insulin being high by itself alone will create more free radicals? Is that what you said?
Correct.
How is that? Why does it do that?
Well, free radicals are signaling molecules. We used to think of them in overly simplistic. We used to think of free radicals, bad, antioxidants, good. They're missing an electron. Antioxidants have an electron. They give it to the free radicals. Everything's good. Now we know better. We know that, you know, they used to be called reactive oxygen species. Now we know a lot better. Some of them are not reactive, but they're oxygen species. Some of them are reactive, but they're not oxygen. They're nitrogen. So the whole picture of antioxidants and free radicals is way more complex than we used to think. But there's still a very strong theory of the free radical theory of aging on of damage to DNA, to mitochondria, etc. And so there are a number of different reasons why insulin can increase free radicals. That's one example of what's wrong with excessive insulin. Other examples of what's wrong with excessive insulin are that it will often cause imbalances in other hormones, like, as I mentioned, leptin, estrogen, testosterone, cortisol. I mean, cortisol has a number of functions. One of them is to raise blood sugar. Insulin has the opposite, to lower blood sugar. And so it creates this teeter-totter. Then thyroid can get pulled into the mix.
So you're saying if insulin is too high, then your cortisol could be too low?
That's a possibility. That's a possibility. Now, the thing is, if insulin is too high, there is one hormone only that lowers blood sugar, and that's insulin. But there are five hormones that raise blood sugar. So yes, cortisol could be too low, but you could have compensations with other hormones.
Could you touch on those? So cortisol is one. What are the other hormones that raise blood sugar?
The big one they teach in almost every physiology class is glucagon. So cortisol, glucagon, noradrenaline, growth hormone, and one other one I'm forgetting at the moment.
Okay.
Yeah.
And to put in perspective, like the high blood sugar, it's a tiny bit. So like you mentioned some numbers. You said the liver can store, how much was it again?
Approximately 90 grams of glucose.
About 90 grams. I assume that depends on how big the person, how big their liver, whatever.
Correct. Yeah, this is general average.
And then how much muscle, you know, muscle could handle a few hundred, depending on how much muscle you got, which makes muscle really useful, I would assume. And then the blood itself could hold a tiny bit. It's like five, like when you said the ideal number being
5.0 millimoles per liter.
Is that basically like 5 grams? Isn't that like 5 grams of sugar in all your blood?
That's about it.
So to put it in perspective, like the difference of normal or diabetic is a gram of sugar in your blood.
Exactly. It's not a lot. It's a fifth.
And there's like how many liters of blood or gallon? There's a lot of blood in the body.
A lot. Yeah.
And it's you're talking a quarter teaspoon of sugar.
Yes.
Which is interesting because when people say don't eat that sugar, don't eat that carbs, like if you eat a piece of fruit that has 30 grams of sugar, obviously it's not being dumped into your blood because
correct.
It's not like people are walking around with 30. Is it milli? What's the
millimoles per liter?
Millimoles per liter. I mean, so there, our body is clearly doing something to titrate, to modulate, regulate the blood to not get crazy, which really makes me think it's not the sugar you're eating, because if it was, it wouldn't go from 5 to 6. It'd be crazy. Like,
yeah, if there was no gating, no distribution of sugar to different organs, it would just spike really, really high. And then normal wouldn't even be 5. Normal might be 100.
So what's the, just that difference of having the extra gram of sugar in your blood, is that in itself a problem?
Yes. By the definition of pre-diabetes, again, using international units, is between 6.0 and 6.4 as A1C. In fasting glucose, that's 6.0 to 6.9. So It's just a fifth of a teaspoon of sugar, and that in itself can do the damage for a number of different reasons. One of those reasons is a process called glycation, which is the binding of a sugar molecule to a protein molecule. And the way I explain it to my listeners, audiences, etc., is imagine pure protein, like an oyster. That's slippery. Imagine cotton candy. That's sticky. When you have the binding of something sticky to something slippery, you get, well, sticky. And that decreases blood flow to those organs, which is why there's so much collateral damage with diabetes.
But you said that decreases blood flow to those organs.
Yeah.
So you're talking about the sugar, the extra gram of sugar, you're saying binds to the protein that organs are made of?
Yeah. So for example, skin, like skin, bones, etc. Those are, although many of them are made of protein. They just have different names. For example, bones are, yes, they're made of calcium, but they're also made of collagen. Collagen is a protein. Immune cells are made of globulins, but the base molecule is a protein, not molecule. It's a nitrogen containing molecule. And so their different proteins have different names based on where they're located.
Okay. So you're saying that one of the issues of the blood sugar being high, just that additional sugar itself, because I think of the sugar being the byproduct of the problem, but you're saying that the extra sugar in itself is a problem because it can bind to proteins and that alters the structure of those proteins and makes them sticky?
Correct. And it's a very complicated relationship in the sense that, yes, the sugar is the problem, but it's also a byproduct of the problem. A comparison that I like to make is inflammation. In some cases, inflammation precedes a condition. In other words, the condition precedes inflammation. For example, a perfect example of this is osteoarthritis versus rheumatoid arthritis. In osteoarthritis, first there was joint degeneration and then there was inflammation. In rheumatoid arthritis, it's the opposite. First, there's inflammation, and then there's joint degeneration. It's a similar effect with sugar.
Okay. So if it's making a protein sticky, like do diabetics walk around and their skin is sticky?
No. It's not that their skin is sticky on the outside, but it is sticky on the inside. So what's on the other side? That's why one common effect of diabetes is dry skin. Because there is less blood flow to areas where it's sticky, quote unquote. That's why there is a higher likelihood of atherosclerosis when arteries are sticky. So the glycation itself creates problems within the body.
But are there other things that could be causing that stickiness in an artery where it might not be? Like, how do we know it's the extra gram of sugar and not some other thing causing that?
Most things are multifactorial, so it's probably not just the 1 gram of sugar. Sometimes it's just that one thing, and sometimes you can just look in standard blood chemistry and see what's going on. Sometimes it's just blood sugar and nothing else. But very often, people with high blood sugar will also have inflammation. So, what is it that caused the stickiness? Is it blood sugar or is it inflammation? What came first? Inflammation or high blood sugar. Sometimes it's other things. It's triglycerides or LDL cholesterol or, other reasons for the stickiness. That's a factor, but it may not be the only factor.
Okay. So we have the extra gram of blood, of sugar floating around, which has its own issues, but it's also like the manifestation of other issues. So from what I understand, there's a big part of diabetes that's really the inability to metabolize sugar. So that sugar is high in the blood because your body's having difficulty oxidizing that inside of a cell, preferably inside a mitochondria.
Yep, that's exactly it.
So can you touch on maybe some of the things that drive that? Like, why, when somebody has diabetes and they're like, well, I don't want to eat carbohydrates, I don't want to have any extra sugar. But it's like, well, your blood sugar's high not because of the sugar you're eating. It's because, like, when they test fasting sugar and it's high, it's obviously not from the food you're eating because you haven't been eating food.
Yes.
Like, my father was hospitalized about a year ago. And going into the emergency room visit, he hadn't eaten food in like 4 days.
Yeah.
And his fasting and his glucose level was like 160 something.
Yeah, quite high.
And there was some, a little bit of acidosis going on. And I'm like, well, obviously that's not from the food he's eating. And they don't want to give him any sugar there.
Yeah.
And to me, it's like, well, he's obviously not burning sugar well.
Yes.
Because he's creating this acidic environment, probably from not getting sugar into the mitochondria. And it's clearly not driven from the sugar he's eating because he hasn't eaten in 4 days. So, like, what's going on there? Is that just the hormonal response from the stress driving one of those four or five hormones you mentioned that are there to elevate blood sugar?
Yeah, that's an interesting phenomenon that happens. Something similar used to happen with my grandma, who was a type 2 diabetic, and she'd maybe her dinner might have been 6 p.m. She'd wake up in the morning at 8 a.m. and her blood sugar is high, even though she's eaten 14 hours, and she'll, what's going on there? It's a process called gluconeogenesis. And if you break down that word, it kind of explains what happens. Gluco, meaning glucose sugar. Neo means new, and genesis means creation. And so it's the creation of new sugar. What does new mean? Where is it coming from? If sugar hasn't come in from food, where is it coming from? It's the conversion of things that aren't sugar into sugar. Things like amino acids from muscles, etc. Things like lactate, pyruvate, etc. Different, for the sake of ease, let's just call it chemicals naturally occurring in the body that go through a different chemical process and become glucose. And so that's the reason why sugar could be high, even though you're not eating sugar. So yeah, it's a hard time processing the sugars you already have and getting them out of the blood.
So that makes me think that stress is really central to this diabetic process.
Potentially. Now, some people think of stress as a mental, emotional process. And yes, it is that. That could raise cortisol levels. But stress could also be, like, on a biochemical level, just not treating your body the right way. And so you might, as mentally, emotionally, you might be an otherwise relaxed, laid back, chill person. But for some reason, your cortisol levels are indeed high. So it's the stress hormone, but maybe not psychological stress.
Yeah, I mean, the stress comes in a lot of ways. It seems like regardless of the stress that's coming into the body, let's say it is, not enough sleep or like a mental or emotional thing. It could be, stored trauma, or it could be infection. It could be like physical stress, like you got an injury, car accident stuff, not eating enough. Whatever it is, it seems like the tool that our body uses to modulate the response is a very blunt object. It's like a little magic box with switches in it. And those switches are like your hormones. And it's like, well, we could turn down these and we could turn up these. It's very like non-specific.
Exactly. And hormones are kind of like a symphony. There's hormonal bouts. So you want not too much or too little of each of any one. You also want the right ratios, the different hormones to each other, like estrogen, testosterone, estrogen, progesterone, et cetera. And yeah, you're right. You don't want too much or too little of any one of them, because let's say you are in a symphony and the trumpets are overpowering everything else. That's going to drown everything else. So if insulin's excessive, maybe cortisol will then rise to meet insulin. Or it could be the other way around. Because again, insulin lowers blood sugar, cortisol raises blood sugar. But we don't want zero blood sugar. We also don't want, 15 millimoles per liter. We don't want, for example, 200 milligrams per deciliter. We want a good level of sugar. And so that's why there's this teeter-totter of cortisol and insulin to keep that blood sugar around, again, that 4.5 to 5.5 millimoles per liter range.
Gotcha. I was looking at your book and there was a section and it was like some of the myths about diabetes. Can you touch on what you think are like some of the common ones that come up with your interactions with folks?
One big one is that diabetes can be cured. And now diabetes can be reversed, but it cannot be cured. Now it seems like just semantics, and I should differentiate between a cure and reversal. If the word cure means you make it go away and it's gone forever and there's nothing you can do to bring it back. But that's not the case. If you prove your diabetes using exercise, nutrition, supplements, and then 3 months later you stop eating the way you used to eat to reverse your diabetes, you stop exercising, you stop taking the supplements, your diabetes will come back. So it could be reversed, but it could be, unreversed. You could bring it back. So there's no cure for diabetes, but there is reversal for diabetes. And again, not 100% of people, but a good amount of diabetics could reverse their diabetes. That's one common myth. Another common myth is that fruits are bad for diabetics. And the thought process goes, well, diabetes has high blood sugar. Fruits are sweet, therefore they have sugar, so they will raise blood sugar as well. Well, there's two reasons why fruits are actually okay and maybe slightly beneficial for diabetics. Reason number one is, yes, there's sugar, but sugar is actually three different molecules. One is glucose, as in blood glucose. And glucose is also found in food. So it makes sense that glucose in food raises blood glucose fast and to a high extent. But there are two other sugar molecules, fructose and galactose, okay?
Fruit has galactose?
No, sorry. Fructose and galactose. I'm not saying fruit has galactose. Those are just three different molecules, glucose, fructose, galactose. So fructose is the dominant sugar found in fruits, not the exclusive sugar. Fruits do have a mix of fructose and glucose, but no galactose. That's really only in dairy. But the dominant sugar in most fruits is fructose. Fructose does not raise blood glucose to the same speed or to the same extent as glucose in food.
Do we know why that is?
Just because of the way it's processed in the liver. Fructose takes more time to get processed in the liver, and glucose takes less time. And so that's reason number one, why fruits are okay for diabetics. Reason number two is they are a pretty concentrated source of fiber, especially dried fruits. The second most impactful nutritional factor when it comes to diabetes reversal is fiber. And fruits are a very concentrated source of fiber.
And why is that? Is it just because it's kind of slowing the drip of sugar?
That's one big reason. One is it slows down the drip. But another one is there's this concept called net carbohydrates. It binds to carbohydrate molecules and makes them unavailable to use by the body.
But isn't that what we want? Like, if diabetics don't metabolize sugar well, like, how does that help the body metabolize sugar better?
So A, yes, they don't metabolize sugar well. B, because they don't metabolize sugar well, it helps them take away some of the sugar to metabolize. So some of them, they are getting excessive sugar, so sugar they shouldn't be getting in the first place. It's okay to get the right amount of sugar, but the problem is not sugar. The problem is excessive sugar. People forget the word excessive.
But how much is excessive? Like, I've learned that the body will use about, and I'm sure this varies based on the size and your activity, about 150 grams of sugar a day, of glucose, whether you eat it or not. So what's excess? Like, anything above the amount that you would naturally use?
Yeah, great question. Excess is, here's my definition of excessive sugar. Excessive sugar is only bad in its impact on calories. So the three most important nutritional factors in order are, one, calories, simple old calories, not even carbs. The second most important factor is fiber. And the third most important factor is protein. As long as you're getting adequate protein and adequate fiber, the rest could be filled with whatever you want. You know, if you want to have a chocolate cake, as long as you're getting adequate fiber and adequate protein, and it's within your caloric budget, it's not going to be very damaging to your blood sugar levels. And you can still have perfect blood sugar levels despite having a chocolate cake or a pizza. So it doesn't matter what the composition is of the remainder after you've covered your bases with fiber and protein. The remainder could be whatever you want.
Okay. So I struggle with some of this, Igor. I can understand how, you know, what kicks out this blood level of sugar being determined as like good or bad. So if, you know, if you don't have too many calories and you're having cake and it doesn't, then it's not going to necessarily cause diabetes because it's not, unless it's more sugar than you need. But to me, the goal is to make energy out of that sugar. And the real problem is that someone's not making adequate energy out of that sugar. I feel like that is more central to that extra gram of sugar floating in this blood. I mean, there might even be some benefits of having an extra gram of sugar because that's what your body's trying to make energy out of. Like, you'd rather have an extra gram than a gram. Like, low blood sugar, like high blood sugar, I could see it can be problematic. But you could have high blood sugar and go have a full-time job, raise a family, like have hobbies. You could function and you have energy to do it. If you have low blood sugar, you could die any minute.
Absolutely.
Like, it just seems like it's better to have a gram too much than a gram not enough. And the real issue is, why is the person not productively making an abundant of energy out of the sugar? Like, what's dry? And that's why I think it's stress. Like, if someone's fasting blood sugar is high, obviously there's a stress involved because those hormones are what's kicking that sugar out into the bloodstream, whether it's through gluconeogenesis, like you mentioned, or I don't know if there's other ways to get more sugar out there, but that's essentially the body taking its own structure, like you said, amino acids from their muscle or their bones or whatever. I don't know where the body prioritizes to get them, but they're making sugar out of that because they need it. It's like, I used to think that because you can make sugar out of protein, that was a reason to do so. And what it really means is sugar is so important that your body's inner wisdom will rip the walls apart to feed the fire.
Correct.
And in doing so, make ammonia and waste energy, detoxifying that ammonia. Like it seems like it's an in-case emergency break glass system that we want to minimize as much as possible.
So we have to figure out why is the body thinking this is an emergency? Anything in the body is because the body perceives this to be a good response to what's going on inside it.
It's trying to save you.
It's trying to save you. So why does it perceive high blood sugar to be the correct response? You know, and sometimes it's because there's excess cortisol or there's excess insulin or both, because often each one will trigger the other.
But is it because of that, or are those just high because that's the body's response to whatever the underlying insult is? Like you said something earlier that was very interesting. When you said there's, when you're discussing the myth, Igor, and you said it can be reversed but not cured. And it made me think of a client I had that was on diabetes medication, that was diabetic. And this was, I would not treat this person the same way now. This was probably 8 years ago, you know, five philosophies before whatever in my journey or whatever. And I had her dramatically limit her carbohydrate intake, and her blood sugar leveled out. She went off medication. Her doctor said, you don't have diabetes anymore. But like now when I think back to that person, you're right. She wasn't cured, because if she resumed to do the same things that gave her, you know, a diabetic response, my guess is she would get it again. So I wouldn't call what I did, that intervention, a Band-Aid, but it surely, maybe it was a Band-Aid. I mean, we manipulated her diet to smooth out the blood sugar, but it didn't necessarily address her ability to metabolize sugar successfully, to make energy, to do all the things that her body's inner wisdom would do if it had it.
Yeah, interesting. And what would you do differently today?
Well, I think I would pay a closer look at what are the potential stressors, you know, whether they're immunological insults or mental, emotional, physical, whatever, you know, what's the sleep hygiene, like what are maybe the contents of the food and what kind of micro things are there of nutrient deficiencies? Why are you unable to get the sugar? What's keeping you from getting sugar into mitochondria so that you have energy to do all the things? So I would focus on that question more. And I couldn't necessarily diagnose what that is. I might be able to give some insight based on what her habits are, and I might be able to point in the direction of the type of medical professional that could do a more specific look at those things. I guess that's what I would do.
Yeah. And where would you start? Would you start with asking her history, or would you start with lab testing or something else?
I probably would start with how do you feel when you wake up? What do you do at night before bed? What are the stressors in your life? How are you managing them? How are you supporting yourself? And, you know, what are the foods? Are you getting the basic things? Like, I think not getting enough food is a stress, and people get stuck in a system where they try to lose weight and they reduce food, but our metabolism is like really smart and it's adjusting. So if you reduce your food for too long, your body just slows metabolism again to try to save your life. And then you have a lower metabolism. So like now to lose weight, you need even less food and you wind up not eating enough. It's like you're living in a place of like scarcity and not abundance. and you start to not have enough micronutrients. Like, I remember just recently looking at the RDA, and I don't know how relevant RDAs are, vitamins and such. I assume there's a lot of individual variability that maybe with like AI in the upcoming years, we'll be able to figure out more customized diet plans for people. But I was looking at potassium and I'm like, how is anybody getting enough of this? Like, some things we just need, like, nobody's eat. Most people I know, they don't eat enough food in general.
Yeah, to meet the micronutrients.
To come close to some of these micronutrient needs. So, like, I wonder how much of that is going on. So, like, are you getting enough protein? Are you getting enough total food? Are those foods easy for you to digest? I would probably look at those kind of things. What are the things, tell me about your approach. You're clearly more of a seasoned veteran with working with folks dealing with diabetes. How do you go about reversing?
Yeah, so it's again, from my perspective as a personal trainer, there's a few things we can do, which is exercise, nutrition, and supplements. And yeah, you're right. So one of the things with diabetics, especially type 2, is the inability to process sugar effectively. And why might that be? Well, we need certain nutrients to process blood sugar. A huge one is chromium. But besides that, a lot of the B vitamins are necessary to process sugar, fats, and proteins. And so sometimes it's just the simplest approaches of just take a multivitamin. And sometimes that's enough. Sometimes the multivitamin does not have adequate amounts of chromium or B vitamins, et cetera, to process it. Maybe you'll need individual chromium or individual B vitamins, et cetera. You could test for micronutrients individually. For that, I refer out. That one's out of my wheelhouse.
Have you had people that have taken chromium and then that was like the magic answer?
It works really well. I've seen people drop their A1C by about 1.5% from chromium alone.
And that's because chromium is used to metabolize sugar?
Yeah. There's something called glucose tolerance factor, and that's where chromium comes in handy.
Oh, can you say that again? Glucose what?
Yeah, glucose tolerance factor.
Okay, I'm not familiar with that.
Okay. Yeah. Often when supplements are sold, you know how there is magnesium glycine, magnesium oxide, et cetera. And so what glucose tolerance factor does is it improves the ability of the body to use glucose. You know how when you see magnesium glycinate, magnesium, et cetera. When you see labels on supplements, it'll often say chromium GTF, glucose tolerance factor. So that's one example. By the way, chromium is particularly helpful in people who have developed diabetes as a result of prednisone. In those people, that can just the usage of adequate amounts of chromium, usually between 300 and 900 micrograms per day, can completely reverse diabetes with no other changes in people who developed it as a result of prednisone use.
Why is that? So prednisone is like a synthetic steroid?
Cortisol. Yeah, cortisol. Yeah.
It's cortisol in a pill, basically, or a cream or...
Correct, exactly. And cortisol raises blood sugar. And chromium, you know, one of the reasons it raises blood sugar is because of the depletion of chromium. Lots of medications have their associated nutrient depletions. Some are very common, like statins deplete CoQ10. Metformin depletes B12, etc. Pharmacists would know this way better than me. But
it's interesting. So when you take... endogenously, the cortisol that you make will naturally use up more chromium. But then if you're taking basically super physiological doses, which are prescribed a lot to like suppress some kind of inflammatory response, which are really common. Steroids are very commonly dished
absolutely.
Out. You're saying that can create essentially a chromium deficiency acutely?
Yeah, you can either call it a chromium deficiency, excuse me, or you can just call it a higher requirement for chromium.
Higher crow. Okay. That's interesting. Okay. So you look at some of these basic things, so chromium, B vitamins that are involved in like basic energy production.
Yeah, exactly. And those are some examples on the supplement side of things. From a nutritional perspective, I like to divide diabetics into one category, which is overweight diabetics, and one category, which is normal weight diabetics, because the nutritional approach is slightly different with both.
Okay.
For weight diabetics, the single most important factor is just good old total calories. More important than carbs, more important than protein, etc. Just normalizing calories will go a long way towards also improving blood sugar levels. The second most important factor in overweight diabetics.
Why does, if somebody is eating, let's say you hold everything constant, so let's say it's a balanced diet, whatever, you know, 33% of each macro.
Yeah.
And they're in, maybe they're not in a surplus, but they have too much weight. So they have a history of being in a surplus and they've put on weight. So let's say they're, 50 pounds overweight. Why does, if you hold everything constant and just reduce the total calories, how does that affect blood sugar levels?
It'll reduce their blood sugar levels. If they're 50 pounds per weight, they're eating enough calories to sustain their current weight. They're very logical, right? And so if they lower their calories, they're basically lowering everything. They're lowering their carbs, they're lowering their fats, they're probably lowering their protein as well.
So the body will then shrink. So if it's carrying, which means it's going to shrink fat, it's probably going to shrink protein too, because it's hard to lose one without losing any of the other also.
Correct.
So how does that, so the fat that they will lose, they will be essentially liberating that from tissue and making energy out of that. But that in itself does not lower blood sugar, does it?
To some extent, because the causes for diabetes is more than one cause. There's a number of different causes. One is high cortisol. One is, the eating excessive calories, et cetera. And so one thing that can happen with insulin resistance is sometimes the lipids, the cholesterol, triglycerides, et cetera, they can block the insulin receptors. So that will lower blood sugar. But just by opening up receptors, it allows the sugar to get out of the blood and inside another cell, like the liver, the muscle, et cetera.
Wait, can you say that again? You said the fats in the blood will block...
Can potentially block insulin receptors.
So if they're blocking insulin receptors, that means you're not getting the nutrition inside of a cell. Okay. So that's including... But if you're talking... So I'm confused. So I'm trying to see if you have someone that's 250 pounds, that would be better if they were 200 pounds. Them essentially disappearing, eating, they're essentially going to have to eat themselves down to 200 pounds. Where's the mechanism that would take their blood sugar from 6 millimoles to 5?
Millimoles per liter, just by eating less food, like all food, for example.
Isocaloric, like if they're 250 pounds for the last 5 years.
Yeah.
So they're eating the amount of food to maintain. So they're not in a surplus. They're just isocaloric. They're just too heavy. There's just too much of a person there.
Yes.
And like, is it the extra 50 pounds? Is that if that's not necessarily the reason that the blood sugar is high? Because there's people that are 50 pounds overweight that don't have high blood sugar. So how does that person becoming smaller in itself lower blood sugar?
Yeah, not everybody who's overweight is also a diabetic, and not everybody who's of normal weight is also a non-diabetic. There are overlaps. There are people who are of normal weight and are diabetics. There are people who are underweight and are diabetics. There are people who are overweight and are also diabetics, and overweight and non-diabetics. But it's a pretty well-established intervention that a very large majority of people who are overweight and lose weight, they either lower their blood sugar or potentially even normalize their blood sugar.
But is it understood exactly why that happens?
There's theories, there's mechanisms. Like the biggest theory is just simply less food. What is insulin resistance? It is a response to excessive nutrition, namely carbohydrates, fats, calories, just coming into the body. And so if it's...
How do we know that? So wait, you're saying insulin resistance is a response to too much food?
That's one response, yeah. There are other responses. There's some people eat too much food. They're 600 pounds and they're not diabetic. They're not even insulin resistant. The comparison I can make is to smoking. Not all smokers will develop lung cancer, but a lot of people who smoke will develop lung cancer compared to people who don't smoke. Yes. Same thing with diabetes. Lots more overweight people will develop diabetes compared to normal weight individuals.
But I just wonder, is it the same thing? Like, could they be diabetic for a similar reason that they're overweight, but they're not necessarily diabetic because they're overweight? It's just the stress on their body is causing them to be overweight. And because, like you mentioned, cortisol raises blood sugar. It also, I think, is a signal to store fat. I assume because the body doesn't know the duration of the stress it's under, And it's like protective, like let's put a little belly fat on you because we don't know when we're going to need it.
To clarify, cortisol actually is a liberation hormone. Cortisol is a breakdown hormone. It causes the breakdown of muscle, but also causes the breakdown of fat in an acute sense. In a chronic sense, cortisol still doesn't make you store stuff. Cortisol still makes you liberate stuff. Unfortunately, with chronic cortisol, like with chronic insulin, you can get cortisol resistance. So it's not that cortisol makes you store body fat or belly fat. Cortisol actually makes you lose belly fat. In an acute sense, in a chronic sense, it's the body ignoring cortisol that makes you store belly fat. Yeah. You can get a resistance to like almost every hormone. It can be insulin resistant. You could be cortisol resistant. It could be thyroid resistant. It could be leptin resistant.
Gotcha. We had someone on the podcast that was talking about insulin resistance in, like I said, I'm easily, I don't want to say gullible, but I can be convinced.
Right.
And talking about the Randall cycle. Were you familiar with the Randall cycle?
No.
Okay. So it was basically like, I hope I don't botch this, but it was basically like within one cell, you could either burn fat or glucose, but you can't burn both at the same time at the same place. So like different populations of cells in different areas could maybe burn different things simultaneously. But within a cell, you're burning one or the other, and the burning of one, the metabolizing of one, suppresses the metabolizing of the other. And I guess the theory goes that under stress, when you have those elevated hormones, which it seems like diabetes is characterized by, these elevated stress hormones, I think you alluded to at least with the cortisol, you have, yeah, that catabolic nature where it's tearing down, it's breaking down. So it's one of the things it's breaking down is fat, which at first sounds good, but not necessarily. So it's liberating fat from your tissues, sending it into the mitochondria to make energy. The problem is that once it's in there, you're not metabolizing glucose, which sets off the alarms. And your liver's like, this is a problem. We're not burning glucose. Because ultimately, your body always wants to be able to burn glucose round the clock. So it triggers those stress hormones even more to initiate, let's say, gluconeogenesis.
Yeah.
So it's breaking down more tissue, converting it to sugar, pushing it out in the bloodstream to say, hey, go get in these cells. We need energy. But when it gets to those cells, it can't because there's already fat in there. And there's like this cycle. Like somebody once said, you won't find a diabetic that's not stressed because the stress came first.
Yeah, I don't know if I 100% agree with that.
I don't either. I don't know either.
But in terms of the body's preference for burning glucose, I don't think that's correct. I think the body prefers to burn fat, but it depends on the activity. One molecule of fat will produce 136 or 138 molecules of ATP, adenosine triphosphate. One molecule of glucose will only produce two to six molecules of ATP. So because of that,
Can you say those numbers? One molecule of fat creates
between 136 and 138 molecules of ATP. Whereas one molecule of glucose will create 2 to 6 molecules of ATP.
No. Not after the 2 to 6 through glycolysis, but once it gets in the mitochondria, it makes about, 34 or 36 or something?
Correct, but still well below the 136 from.
Right, so that's a good point. So I used to think about this a lot, and I don't know what's right here, because I used to think because fat has more of that, let's say, potential energy in a gram of fat relative to a gram of sugar or carbohydrate, that you should burn that it's like more efficient fuel. But I was taught that that's the wrong question to ask, and that the real question is, given, let's say, an unlimited amount of fat or glucose and a fixed amount of time, what makes more ATP? And I was told that given a certain unit of time,
yes,
you make more energy with the glucose than the fat. Because you're essentially running the system hotter. You're revving the engine. You're increasing that metabolic rate.
Yes. Exactly. So what I'm saying is that fat is a preferred fuel source when there's no time limit. In low intensity activity, like sleep, like sitting, gotcha. Like chatting right now, fat is the preferred fuel source. In higher intensity activities, glucose becomes the dominant fuel source because, yes, it produces less ATP, but it produces them faster.
Gotcha. But is that constant throughout any tissue? Because doesn't the brain not use fat? Like, isn't your nervous system running on glucose all the time?
Yeah, it's running on, everything is running on a mix of glucose and fat. I can only think of maybe just one, I think just red blood cells. Yeah. They're the only ones that use only one. Every other tissue uses, I think, both. And to a very small extent, even protein. But that's a very, very minor fuel source. So exactly. In high intensity activity, glucose is the preferred fuel source because it makes less, but it makes it fast. So for example, if we're sitting there right now, just, you know, relaxing, et cetera, our energy is coming about 60-40%, 60% from fat, 40% from glucose. Now, if I'm going to go for a sprint right after our chat, I'm going to go for a workout. If I do sprints, then depending on the duration of my sprints, if it's 10 seconds or less, it's going to be almost exclusively glucose. Now, if my sprints extend to 60 seconds, so it's no longer like a sprint, completely a sprint, then the contribution is going to be something like 70-80% glucose, and the remainder will be fat. And also the duration of the activity. The closer you get to the end of a long race, like a marathon, the more glucose you're going to burn. Sorry, the more fat you're going to burn because the glucose has been used earlier in the race. When there's a time limit, glucose is the preferred fuel source. When there's no time limit, then fat is the preferred fuel source. But at any given time, the body is burning both simultaneously, except for, again, unless you're going to do a sprint of 10 seconds or less.
So you say at rest, it's about 60%. Fat, 40% glucose, and that's like the average, the aggregate of the whole system, factoring in the different areas are using.
Roughly speaking, somewhat it depends on the composition of your diet. Is if you're heavily on a fat-based diet, like a keto diet, it's going to be more fat, less glucose. If you're on a high-carb diet, it's going to be more of those less fat. But for a fairly mixed diet, it's going to be about 60-40.
Okay, so you talked about like exercise or. Touch on a little bit there. How do you view exercise in that framework of trying to reverse the diabetic process?
Yeah. So when it comes to exercise in its role in diabetes reversal, we have to ask, what is the purpose of exercise? How would it reverse diabetes? And there are two ways. Either it can decrease the spike, or it can decrease the spike of glucose, or it can decrease the duration of the spike. And there are two mechanisms by which exercise can accomplish diabetes reversal. One is something called glucose disposal. That is the primary fuel source for working muscles is, as we just talked about, glucose. And both cardio and strength training accomplish that. However, the other mechanism by which exercise can lower blood sugar levels is with something called glycogen storage. And I know you know this, but for listeners who don't know, the word glycogen is the plural word for glucose. So many glucose molecules combined are called glycogen. So glycogen storage is the other method of lowering blood sugar. And so exercise, all exercise, cardio and strength training accomplishes glucose disposal. But only strength training accomplishes glycogen storage. Because if we have greater storage space, i.e. greater muscles, we can store more glycogen in there. So we want to use both strength training and cardio for different reasons. However, they do have different effects. The effects of cardio on glucose disposal, cardio only lowers blood sugar levels for just about 1 to 2, maybe 3 days after you do it. If you've been doing cardio regularly for 10 years, the day you stop is, you know, within a day or two.
Does it always lower? So if your blood sugar is normal, does cardio lower your blood sugar?
No, for non-diabetics, it doesn't do that. What happens for people who are not diabetics, when they start exercising, whether it's cardio or strength training, it doesn't matter, is adrenaline rises. Adrenaline is like a fast-acting cortisol. So as cortisol does, so does adrenaline. It raises the blood sugar. To counteract that, the pancreas releases insulin and lowers blood sugar. The net effect is no rise or lowering in blood sugar levels.
But doesn't exercise, during the exercise, raise your blood sugar?
Some people yes, some people no.
Do you want it to, or is there inherently a problem with it being raised during that, like short term, like during the activity itself?
It's not something you should deliberately seek out. You shouldn't deliberately seek out to raise your blood sugar. But if you were to test a blood sugar level in the middle of a workout, and I've actually tried this with both diabetic and non-diabetic clients. In diabetics, again, it depends if they're on medications, if so, which medications are taking insulin. But in diabetics, their blood sugar could spike during a workout. In fact, we had one client, his blood sugar would go up. I don't know if this would mean anything in my units, but it would go up to 15.0. That's very high. Normal, by the way, fasting blood glucose normal is 5.0. So it would triple. You know, don't quote me on this. I think it's the equivalent of about 240 milligrams per deciliter. It's very, very high during a workout. Within an hour and a half, it would drop to normal, like lower than his resting blood sugar levels. Whereas when I've tested with non-diabetics, it goes up, but only like 0.2, 0.5 millimoles per liter, like a negligible amount.
If it's short term, why don't you want it high? Like if you're exercising, you're increasing the demand of energy.
Yes.
As you say, if there is a time constraint on that energy demand, carbohydrates are prioritized, or burning sugar is prioritized. Don't you want more sugar running through the blood to meet that demand of energy?
It is. And then insulin comes out and it takes it out of the blood and into the muscles. Like there's no use in having high blood sugar during exercise. You want it not in the blood. You want it somewhere else. You want it in the muscles.
Oh, gotcha. It shouldn't be in the blood. It should be in a tissue.
Exactly.
Making it to be okay. Okay. And how are you defining cardio? When you say cardio, like you're basically lumping exercise into two things, like cardio or strength.
Correct.
Like you mentioned strength, and in my language, strength refers to really like force. But you reference the benefit of the strength is really the glycogen storage, the glucose disposal, which is really more muscle-based, not necessarily related to how strong someone is. I mean, there's obviously a correlation there, but it's really the benefit of strength is coming from the muscle that you're developing, you're building from it.
Yes.
And so can you touch on the benefit of the cardio, how that's happening, and how you're really defining what cardio?
Yeah. So I don't use any of my own definitions, but the definition of cardio is it's defined based on pulse. The pulse is it has to cross the aerobic threshold. The aerobic threshold happens at about 65% of the maximal heart rate. That's cardio. And the duration has to be long enough so that you actually have cardiovascular adaptations. If you just raise it up to 65% for 1 minute and then you go back down, you go sit in your chair again, you're not going to get cardiovascular improvements. So it has to be long enough. And so how long is long enough? The more advanced you are, the longer it needs to be elevated, about 65%. But for a beginner, it needs to be about 65% for 20 minutes, three times per week or more. Then you actually have improvements in VO2 max. If it's below that, it might be beneficial for other reasons, but it's not improving your cardiovascular injuries.
Okay, so you just mentioned that you're doing that and it should improve your VO2 max, which for the listeners is essentially how well you utilize oxygen.
Correct.
Like how much oxygen you could utilize. Is that given a fixed time, I think?
Yeah, it's milliliters per kilogram per minute. So yeah, per time, yeah.
So what role does that play with diabetes?
So the method through which cardio improves diabetes is glucose disposal. When muscles work, their dominant fuel source is glucose. And so blood sugar rises so that insulin will also rise and get it out of the blood and inside the muscles for usage. So that's how that lowers blood sugar levels.
So that's just during the actual exercise then?
Yes, as well as afterwards. And the reason that it works afterwards, again, just for 2 or 3 days, it doesn't make you insulin sensitive forever. Or heck, not even the long term, just for a few days afterwards. What cardio does, which is unique to cardio, which strength training does not accomplish, is A, it increases the number of mitochondria you have. It has the potential to double the number of mitochondria, but not only does it increase the number of mitochondria, it improves the efficiency of the mitochondria, the enzymes working within the mitochondria to make ATP, and it can triple that. Because of that, that's why cardio has such a favorable effect for, again, up to 1 to 3 days later.
So cardiovascular training, as you define it, 20 minutes of a pulse of 65% or above.
Yes.
A few times a week. That's increasing the number of mitochondria within the muscle tissue or overall in all your tissue?
Muscle cells and heart cells.
Muscle cells and heart cells. And there's an implication that more mitochondria is better because you're just going to be able to make more ATP overall?
Correct. And to make ATP, one of the things that you can use to make ATP is glucose.
Gotcha. So does that increase, if you hold everything constant and somebody just doubles their mitochondria, well, I assume they would get heavier. Mitochondria has to have some mass to it. I wonder how much mitochondria weigh.
Yeah, good question.
Does that in itself increase someone's nutritional demands then to feed that mitochondria?
Absolutely. People who exercise more need more calories.
Right. Okay. And so that's one of the drivers of why they would have that more need, because they literally have more mitochondria that's created from the adaptation from that type of stress.
Exactly.
Okay. So going back to the strength then, why isn't it the same thing? So if you are strength training and you put on muscle, don't you also, because of the sheer volume of muscle, shouldn't that increase the number of mitochondria also?
Potentially. So I don't like lumping all strength training into one category, because there are different ways of strength training. I'll categorize them in two ways. One is more power-oriented training, where you're using heavy weights but lower repetitions, and one is more endurance-oriented strength training, not to be confused with endurance-oriented cardio training. So that's where I differentiate between muscular endurance and cardiovascular endurance. But let's just stick to strength training of heavy weights versus light weights, okay? With light weights, yes, you do increase your mitochondria. With heavy weights, you're not, because the weight is heavy, the duration of the exercise or the duration of a single set of exercises is not long enough to increase your mitochondria. And because of that, heavy weights have their benefits for other reasons, but they don't increase mitochondria very well.
Gotcha. So let's dial this back together to someone that maybe is flirting with diabetes or has a history of it. You work in the gym. I have a history of working in a gym too. We could probably nerd out on programming for fitness related things for a long time. But for someone that doesn't have a history and is not going to go to the gym and do cardio 3 times a week and strength 2x a week, what do you think is like the minimum effective dose where somebody can really start to move the needle in how they feel and how their body is managing glucose? Like, where should somebody begin if they are just trying to begin?
Yeah, great question. If you're looking for the minimum effective dose, I think what you can do is you can sit at home on the couch, squeeze every muscle you have, your forearms, your chest, your back, your glutes, your legs, with maybe about 60 to 80% of your maximum force, and hold that contraction until your muscles start to burn. Then relax for a minute or two. And then do that again about 4 or 5 more times. And all in all, that might take you just about 10 or 15 minutes. And if that's all you'll do, you'll be able to move to bring down your A1C a little bit.
Gotcha. It's something I would add to that that I think is probably underrated for many people is taking a walk. And I don't know if it was a study or an article, but I'm talking about like the post meal walk, maybe not like immediately after, but soon after, or even right before for a similar reason. Just even like a leisurely walk, activating really like the largest muscles in our body, in our legs, and like stimulating that response where they're increasing the blood flow to the skeletal muscle and bringing nutrients and getting like a exercise stimulated insulin response, essentially, where you are saying, here's a little bit of demand. So, hey, cells, open up your doors.
Yep.
So you could put this sugar somewhere and give it and put it to use. And I don't know if there's a big difference of right before meal or soon after. And I think it comes really natural to a lot of people to like want to go for a leisurely walk to like just to help digestion. But I think it also can be play a big role where your blood sugar as that meal you eat isn't just being digested and being dumped into blood. It's like it has somewhere to go.
Yep, exactly. And the benefits of walking are seriously underrated. I once had a university professor that said that if they made a pill that had the benefits of walking, it would be priceless. Walking is free and available today.
Yeah. And I think the benefits are just so far reaching beyond regulating blood sugar. I mean, you could sort out a lot of the suffering in your life by going for a walk.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's good for a lot of things. It's good for your blood sugar. It's good for your blood pressure. It's good for mental health and so on.
Mental health. Yeah, for sure. I think a lot of people could use it. I go for walks pretty regularly and I'm astonished like how few people in the neighborhood, like you'll see a couple regular walkers, but it's like clearly 95% of the people.
Yeah, they're not walking.
Just never do it. You know, the walk from their door to their car in the driveway is about it.
Yeah, they're not even getting 2,000 steps a day.
We touched on a lot of stuff. So we got a little bit of all the categories. Is there anything else you feel like is important on this topic that you want to touch on? Or
sleep. Both is direct effects and it's indirect effects.
Okay.
The direct effects are that you need less insulin to bring your blood sugar down. Now, it doesn't in and of itself directly affect blood sugar levels, but indirectly it does. And I'll touch on the indirect way in a second. But directly, it actually affects the amount of insulin you need to release in response to the carbohydrates that you need to bring in. That's the direct.
Are you talking about during the night sleep or just when you sleep better in general, you need less insulin?
In general, the second one. And indirectly, the effects of sleep might be even more significant than its direct effects. The most obvious one is if your quantity of sleep is low, you just have more of an opportunity to eat. If instead of sleeping 8 hours, you sleep for 6 hours, it's an extra 2 hours where you could potentially munch on something. That's one thing. Second of all, if you're tired the next day because of either inadequate sleep or adequate but low quality sleep, you're going to be low energy. What do you need to bring up your energy? You're going to drink coffee. Now, coffee's not bad, but you're probably not going to drink it black. You're probably going to put sugar and syrup and milk and cream into it. And that's not it. You're probably also going to be hungrier because your signals from your fullness signals are blunted. You're not going to hear the fullness message as well as if you're well-rested. So those are the far-reaching consequences of poor sleep on your nutrition. There's also the effects of poor sleep on your exercise. If you're tired, you're not going to feel like exerting and expending energy in the gym. You might skip your workouts. And if you go to your workouts, you're not going to put as much effort or burn as many calories. So yeah, the effects of poor sleep are very, very far-reaching.
I highly recommend putting sugar in your coffee.
It is delicious.
I don't think sugar is the enemy, even for diabetics.
I agree. As I stated in one of the myths in my book, is sugar is not the enemy. It's kind of misguided.
Right. In fact, from what I understand, sugar lowers cortisol to some extent.
Correct. The question is how low should we go and how much cortisol should we have at different times of the day?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I wonder. And that might vary. Like, I don't even know if there's going to be hard parameters for that that would be constant across the population.
Yeah. There's the problem.
Like people's stress tolerance or like resilience varies dramatically.
Yes, exactly. There's in the research there is what they call high stress reactors and low stress reactors. In other words, both groups of people are asked to perform the same task, whatever the stressful task may be, whether it's public speaking in front of an audience and submerging your hand in very cold water, etc. And some people, in response to it, their cortisol spikes. Other people, the event is the same, but the cortisol doesn't spike. So that's one of the things that makes cortisol really, really difficult to study.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's funny, I have a sister and she's very good at problem solving, like getting tasks done, solving problems. And like, she'll mention something and I'll be like, that sounds stressful. I wouldn't want to do that.
Yeah.
And she's like, what are you talking about? Like, you just do, like, life gives you these things, you just do the things. Like, we grew up in the same household, same parents. She's a little older than me. And she, like, nothing seems to really, like, the thing, like, we look at stress totally different.
Yeah, to her, this is fun. To you, this is annoying.
Yeah. One other question on the food stuff. So if somebody is, I want to get your opinion. If somebody's trying to approach, let's say their blood sugar's creeping up, the A1C or the fasting glucose, or they, you know, they have full-blown diabetes, they're on medication, from a like macro perspective as far as how you divvy up protein, fat, carbohydrate, is there a general template that you recommend people starting at?
Yeah. So generally speaking, the first step always is just count your total calories. And the way I like to have people count their total calories is take your ideal body weight in pounds and multiply that by 15. Add in whatever you plan to spend on exercise.
Well, that's a simple way. You just do ideal weight by 15.
Yeah, exactly. So if somebody is 250, but they want to be 200, and they plan on, to make the numbers simple, they plan on exercising 3 times per week, but it averages out to about 100 calories per day through exercise. So you do 200 times 15 plus 100. So that's 3,100 calories. That's your baseline. Below that, then you calculate your protein requirements. And so for a person who is under 60 and is strength training, they should be getting 1.6 grams per kilogram per day of protein. For somebody over 60, it's a bit higher, maybe 2.0, 2.2 grams. Now, we know that 1 gram of protein is 4 calories. And so let's say somebody does need, to make the number simple, 150 grams of protein per day, that's 600 calories. So if somebody's entitled to, let's say, 3,000 calories out of those 600 of protein, they're left with 2,400, that's not protein. After that, they should be on a lower carbohydrate diet, if not a low-carb diet.
Why is that?
So usually it's, even when calories are equal between low-fat and low-carb diets, blood sugar comes down the same amount, but insulin does not. Insulin comes down more on lower-carb diets.
Because fat doesn't need insulin to get into a cell.
Correct.
But why is that inherently better? Like, I've seen studies where they've reversed diabetes on, like, low-fat, high-carb diets. I don't know what to make of all this.
You're right. Those high-carb diets that reverse diabetes, they're high-carb, where they forgot to mention, is they're high-carb, high-fiber. Not high carb, low fiber. It's one thing to get your carbohydrate. You can get 70% carbs from spaghetti, rice, and potatoes. You can get 70% carbs with beans, lentils, and peas. The latter is much healthier than the former. They're both carbohydrates, but one is a very high fiber carbohydrate. So then in terms of macros, whatever you get with protein, the next about 40% should be carbs, and the remainder should be fat.
So you recommend about 40% carb. So definitely
about 40% carbs.
That's not a low carb. That would be
no.
Okay. So that's so on a percentage basis for the rest of it, is that about 20-25% protein, somewhere around there then?
Thereabouts, yeah.
Okay. Okay. So that doesn't sound like low carb. You know, for a lot of years, I thought low carb was way lower than it actually is.
Yes.
Which I think a lot of people fall in that trap, especially if you've gone through like low carb and keto fads, and it's like you think you need to have 70 grams of carbs, and it's like, oh, you could have 150 grams of carbs and still be low carb.
Yeah, people don't understand the definition of low carb. They think it's one solid number. They think low carb means 100 grams per day. That's fine, but what if you need 3,000 calories per day? 100 grams of carbs is only 400 calories. That's very, very low. Some people, especially the keto group, they think 50 grams of carbs, even 30 grams of carbs is low carb. That's considered extremely low carb. The official definition of low carb is 40% of your total calories. It always has to be in relation to total calories, not an absolute amount.
Gotcha. That is amazing news for so many people if they understood it. 40% of your calories could be carbohydrate, and you are not eating a lot of carbs.
Yeah.
That is low. Like in the bodybuilding world, where most people are lean, they're generally 50 to 60%.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. They need those carbs for training hard, and also total calories are king when it comes to body composition.
And also carbohydrates, and because of that relationship of sugar and cortisol and adrenaline, carbohydrates spare protein.
Exactly.
So because one of the reasons your body turns on a hormone to liberate your protein to make sugar is because it doesn't have enough sugar for what it wants to do. So giving it enough sugar, carbohydrate, tells your body it doesn't need to tear its muscle apart to make sugar.
Exactly, yeah. Protein requirements go down when carbohydrates are normalized.
I've seen some pretty big dudes on like 100 grams, guys that are well over 3,000 calories a day, eating 100 grams of protein a day.
Yeah.
And they're ginormous, but they're eating insane amount of carbs and they're lean. And they're probably not diabetic.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, if you look at bodybuilding competitors, there's such a wide variety in terms of their carb to fat ratios. But of course, the one thing that's constant about almost all of them is their protein intake and their total calories.
This was a lot of information. We touched on a lot of stuff, and I'm sure we could talk for a lot longer, Igor. I really enjoyed it. The name of your book is Type 2 Diabetes Reversal.
Secrets, yeah. Type 2 Diabetes Reversal Secrets.
Type 2 Diabetes Reversal Secrets. We'll link to it in the show notes here. Thank you for reaching out and taking the time to have the discussion. I know that we're not 100% on the same page, and it's great to be able to talk to somebody and just kind of bounce ideas off of. And I plan on keep trying to figure these things out along the way. Maybe one day I'll understand some of this stuff.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for having me on the show and for the very thoughtful questions. I really appreciate it.
Sure. And for the listeners, always grateful for your listening. If you enjoyed the show and you think you know somebody else that would, please share it. Have a great day, everybody.